Okay, so a little bit on ethics. So I have a couple of slides just to get you to think about what ethics are and why they're important for research. And I'm thinking you may have heard a little bit about some controversies that show up from time to time in terms of ethics. So we'll kind of think about that potentially in relation to the session. So basically, ethics are a set of moral principles that researchers have agreed they will use to guide the way that they kind of conduct themselves. And from a general point of view, it's how groups or professions behave. So in medicine, people who work in medicine have a set of ethical principles that are specifically linked to medicine. In educational research, there are a set of ethical principles that are specifically linked to educational research. There are also, and one is BIRA, the ethical guidelines. There's also a general social science framework by the ESRC, which is the Economic, Social, and Research Council. And there are some specific guidelines through psychology, but other disciplines might have them. So the psychology guidelines are through the British Psychological Society and the APA. On Moodle, I have a copy of the most recent guide from as many organizations that are appropriate for the education TRIPAS in a section on ethics, and there are a bunch of specific guides. Now, the one that is most important for your R&I is the BIRA. And actually, when you fill out your ethics form, you will say, and you should have already done, that you have read through the BIRA guidelines, because they are the overarching frame. If you're doing something in psychology, for example, then it might be useful to have a look at the psychology guidelines. But one of the things that's pretty much the case is that when it comes to social science research, the core principles are pretty similar. There's not a lot of variation. They may frame things a little bit differently in terms of how they talk about them. The core principles are pretty universal. So why research ethics are important is that we as researchers, which you are about to become a researcher, have a professional responsibility to avoid the exploitation of research participants. And exploitation can mean that you're doing something harmful, but it can also be wasting folks' time as well. And that's especially true when you're doing research in schools, because if a child is going to be taken out of their lesson to participate in your research, then the research should be meaningful because they're losing time in their lessons to participate in the research. So it is thinking about conducting research that is really being fair to participants as well as creating new knowledge. And research, of course, can be harmful to research participants, but it can also be harmful to individual researchers, universities, relations with schools, and the research community as a whole. When there are controversies related to ethics, it has a knock-on effect. So there's a fairly controversial high-profile case with Facebook a few years ago, where Facebook, without telling people, put individuals into an experimental situation where they were seeing certain posts from people. So Facebook was deciding that they could see a certain group of posts but not another. And they were looking at if they showed people certain kinds of posts versus other kinds of posts, if it changed their behavior and their engagement with Facebook. And it was published as a psychology experiment. But the participants had no idea they were in it. At the time, Facebook's user agreement did not include the people who were doing research. And so it was a big controversy in terms of whether or not it was ethical to have done this. Now, lots of companies put out various kinds of little experimental manipulations for marketing purposes. And so Facebook has done this sort of thing and continues to do this sort of thing to us to this day in terms of just a general Facebook model. Like, the advertisements that we see on Facebook are based on them accessing our data when we go to other sites. And we have given them permission to do that. But we might not necessarily give just anyone permission to see all of our history in our ordinary lives, but Facebook is kind of getting all of that information to kind of, from their perspective, to give us a better experience on Facebook. And so companies do a lot of things under marketing, but when you turn that into research, the game changes. Because when it comes to research, we have a responsibility not to harm our participants in any way. And so what might be happening in terms of various kinds of things that companies might do is different from what we can do in research. We have to be very mindful of the rights of our participants and how that not only affects our participants, but it affects our own reputation as well as the reputations of the institutions where we work. Because the universities that employed the individuals who published the paper had to release public statements about their decision making. They were on the hook because of this. So it's important to be treating participants fairly and all of that, but it does have a knock-on effect, and that's why ethics are really important. So in educational research, some of the things that are specifically important for us in terms of ethics are related to the kind of different purposes that we might be using in terms of driving knowledge and some of the sensitive issues that we might be looking into. So there are things that as educators we might be really interested in looking at, but they're quite sensitive issues. And we have to kind of think around those in terms of research. So I'm going to give you some examples of a couple of projects that students did this last year that they had to really think about the ethical part of. So one was a student was doing work. They wanted to look at the kinds of support that students with special educational needs receive and whether they're getting appropriate support. And as they started thinking more and more about that research question, they found it difficult within the specific area that they were working to actually interview children or even to interview parents because they were working with children who had fairly extreme conditions. And so what they did instead is they had interviews with social workers because they felt that that was a much easier place in terms of the ethics around the issues to deal with their research questions. So they might not have necessarily been able to answer the exact question that they thought about last June because they had to think about some of the ethics. There were a couple of students this last year who looked into various issues around sexuality and pornography and sex education. And they started to think about their research questions and how that's a very sensitive topic. And if they talk to people who are under 18, that might be really difficult for them as young researchers. And so what they did instead is they interviewed folks who were over 18 to reflect on their experiences as teenagers. Because it's a little bit easier when you have an adult who can give consent and they can upfront know, okay, I might be talking about something that's a bit difficult, but I have agreed upfront that I'm going to talk about that issue with you. Where a child, it's maybe a little bit more, is actually more challenging. So this is in education, there are times when we're dealing with sensitive issues and we have to think a little bit about how we might be able to investigate certain research questions to keep those sensitive issues in mind. The other thing that's quite important in a school context is because we're working with children who are used to, in schools, being told by adults what to do, we have to be very careful that they are willing participants in our research. So when I go into a school to collect data, I am another grown-up, and in primary school especially, children are used to doing what grown-ups tell them to do. So I have to be very sensitive to making sure that they understand, in a way that makes sense to them, that what they're doing is voluntary, and they can stop at any time. So it's not a coercive, you must participate in this research. A few other things that are kind of special issues linked to education is that quite oftentimes, so this term gatekeeper, which is usually somebody who's at a school who is giving us access to participants, they can quite oftentimes have a vested interest in the research or the outcomes of the research, and we have to keep those sorts of things in mind in relation to conducting research. Now, this is less of a case for you and more of a case for when we have students, research students, who are working and doing research degrees, so our part-time master's students who are working in schools and they're using their school to collect data. They have this vested interest because they are also, they're using the schools where they work for the data for their research degree. You might not necessarily have that, but if you already have a link to people at the school, so if your parent is employed at that school, or if you have other roles in that school, then there is kind of a dual interest that you have that you have to be careful in terms of navigating so that people don't feel like they're being coerced into doing the research. Or the other one, if it was your own research with your own school and potentially a head teacher who might be your boss. So if you were a teacher and the head teacher said, well, you will find this finding, and you don't, then they could be upset about it. And they, what would be unethical is if someone said, no, you must report it as the finding I want you to report. You can't actually report what you found. And so that's where sometimes this conflict of interest can come into place in terms of education and being aware of those kinds of things and trying to present research as neutrally as possible. And so I think the other thing that is useful in terms of educational research, it may or may not be your project, but it's an important thing to think about, is oftentimes educational research may not necessarily be about interviewing a child outside of their lesson, but it may be about observing a lesson. It may be that school is doing something slightly new that was developed by the researcher, and it can begin to be treated as just another lesson versus research. And that kind of, again, in that kind of they kind of are your participants, willing participants or not, and the ethics around when it becomes kind of a lesson versus an individual session. And those are ethical questions that educational researchers have to grapple with, that it, on top of the general ethics of treating their participants with dignity. Okay. So I like these five principles. They guide the general ethics at the university. I've got a few principles linked to Bira next, but I like these, which is beneficence and non-maleficence, which I'll explain in a minute, fidelity and responsibility, integrity, justice, and respect for people's rights and dignity. So the American Psychological Association and their ethics talk about these five things in terms of being important, and you're going to have a little activity in a minute comparing this and Bira principles as well. But basically, it is about doing no harm, participating in research creates no more risk than everyday life. You give people the opportunity to decide if they're going to participate in research, and you treat data responsibly and with integrity. So you're not making up data, you're not lying about data, but you're treating the data as honestly as possible. There are biases that researchers bring to research all the time, and it's trying to avoid as many biases as possible and reporting data honestly. And that's an important part of research in terms of research ethics. So it's responsibility to people in terms of doing no harm, letting people choose, but the other responsibility is about being having integrity when it comes to data and both in terms of collection and in terms of reporting. Bira says that they consider that all educational research should be conducted with an ethic of respect for the person. Knowledge, this is the stuff that we learn from research. Democratic values, this is like the idea of people being able to choose to be in research. The quality of academic freedom, of academic research, and academic freedom. And that is that you don't have to do research just because it is what the school says you have to do, or because this is what the local authority says that you have to do, but it is research based on a better understanding of, or of gaining new knowledge in areas that are important for educational research as a whole, but it's not because someone is telling you you have to do X. So I do like this quote. I don't tend to put quotes on very often, but this is one of my favorites from Bira, which is basically saying the underpinning aims of the guidelines, which are their ethical guidelines, is to enable educational researchers to weigh up all the aspects of the process of conducting educational research within any given context, from student research projects, like you're doing, to large-scale funded projects. and to reach an ethically acceptable position in which their actions are considered justifiable and sound. So the one of the first jobs you'll be thinking about in relation to ethics and risk assessment form is basically making some of these decisions and talking about some of these decisions with your supervisor. If you're using existing data, or if you're using library-based research, the job is much easier. But if you're collecting new data, then these are important things to be keeping in mind as you're starting new data collection. Quite oftentimes, if you're part of an existing project, the existing project will have had to have gone through quite a rigorous ethical clearance as part of the main project. And so if you're part of an existing project, you should ask your supervisor about their own ethical application and the permissions that they received as part of that, because that will be important as well. So kind of similar to APA, BIRA talks about three core areas in terms of their principles: responsibility to participants, responsibilities to sponsors of research, and responsibilities to the community of educational researchers. So we've talked a lot about participants in terms of it's important to make sure that they are safe and they're doing research that is meaningful. The sponsors of research, this is the responsibility to, if someone has grant funding, it's making sure that the grant funding is being used appropriately. From your point of view, the university is sponsoring your research. So when you go out into the community collecting data, you are a representative of the university, and what you do reflects on the university. So treating your research ethically has a positive influence on the university. Doing something unethically has a negative influence on the university. So it's thinking about that responsibility, and then the responsibilities to communities of researchers really goes into the heart of thinking about having integrity about data. So not lying about your data, but being honest in terms of what you've done. So this is a little bit more detail in terms of these three core areas. So when it comes to thinking about responsibilities that we have to participants, these are human participants, usually in our research. There are specific guidelines for animals, but I don't think anyone will be using animal participants. It includes living human beings, so any interaction we're doing in terms of new data collection. It includes human data and records, so even if you're using existing data, you still have participants, even though you might not see them directly. And it also includes, as an additional element that you probably won't have to deal with, but it includes human beings who have recently died, so there are ethical principles around things like cadavers and medical training, embryos, fetuses, human tissue, and body fluids. And with the increased interest in the social sciences and things like DNA research, there is an increased awareness of how we have to be thinking about that as well in terms of principles. The other thing that is kind of up and coming in terms of ethical change is how do we deal with big data that have been collected through online sources that might not have been researched. So, a big credit card company may have lots of data that they want a researcher to analyze. I have a colleague who does research in visual perception. So he does research on how we make sense of various kinds of scenes. And he started doing data analysis from data from an online game, which I think is something like, I can't remember what it's called. But basically what you are is you're an agent at the airport scanning stuff. And there may be things showing up in people's luggage and you have to identify it. And he's been able to work with the company to get this very practical example of how we make sense of the world around us and how we scan scenes, because it's much more real world than the kinds of things that people might be doing in psychology labs. But how do you deal with that sort of data ethically? Because people who have participated in that game haven't necessarily consented to the research. So when data are kind of available, but you don't have consent, how do we deal with that ethically? So that's a big thing that people are talking about now, as well as getting a little bit more interest in terms of what is appropriate for DNA. Quite often DNA is collected by taking a cotton swab and just wiping the side of your mouth. and that gets frozen, not the cotton swab, but the DNA gets frozen. And there are lots of rules about how long can you keep it, where can you keep it, what are the various things about security. And these are things that I think, especially in the social sciences, we're having to think about more. Medicine has good models for us, but these are a couple of ideas that are changing in terms of ethical principles. They are moving all the time because the questions that we have in research are moving all the time. Okay, so what I want you to do, that was me not changing this to Moodle. I'll do that right now while you start your discussion. So I'd like you, there are a few laptops at every table, so if you would work with a group, it doesn't matter, you can have a few groups at your table just working around a laptop, to select one of the ethical principles that are on Moodle. You can choose which one you want, and to think about what are the kinds of things that they are suggesting in terms of your responsibilities as a researcher, what are the kinds of risks that you have to think about in terms of the research that you might be doing. So go ahead and go to Moodle. There's a section towards the bottom on advice and slides and such, and there's a whole section on ethics. This is the way for me to get you to that section so you know where it is. And choose one and see if you can work through a couple of the questions in yellow related to that framework. Okay, can I bring us together for kind of a group chat? I want to focus on the last question, which you might not have necessarily made it to, but it relates to all the other questions, which is what should you consider in your own research to meet ethical responsibilities that you will have as an education researcher? What are some of the ideas that you talked about that you've got to consider and be mindful of? Other good conversations, yes?
Don't ask really questions. Like, don't be like, do you think this is really bad? Or something. Sometimes be like, yeah, because they're kids and they want to be smart.
Yeah. Well, no, you will talk tomorrow about how to design questionnaires and interviews, because there may be times when you want to ask a slightly leading question, because you'll lead in a different way later and you want to see how people are responding. But I think when you create a value judgment, that's where you have to be really careful, which is really good. Good. Other things you talked about is making sure you're aware of. Before we talk, this group had a very good idea, which I think is useful to think about, which is what? About participants dropping out.
Yeah, we were discussing to the worry of participants dropping out at whatever stages of the project and how
ethical it is to like make them stay and let them go.
Facilitating.
And the answer is it's not ethical.
But we talked about how, for adults, what you have to do is just make them aware that they can withdraw at any time, whether it's during the session or after the session, so they know they can do that. In practice, usually speaking, with adults, by the time they, when they know about the study and by the time they have agreed to be in the study, they kind of know what they've agreed to and they don't tend to want to withdraw. So it's a rare thing. It happens from time to time, but it's quite rare. I was talking to this group about, and after someone finishes a study, because they could actually withdraw at any time after they've left. If they leave your research and they decide, I don't want to do this, I don't want to be part of this data, they can do that. But after they've left the research, the chances are even smaller that they're going to come back to you and say they don't want to do the research. If they do, you have to honor that. But we were talking about kids are the ones that are the group that we have to be probably the most mindful of in relation to this. Because they're not giving consent in the same way that adults are, so the adults are getting a full sense of what the study is about and what the risks are, and kids won't necessarily understand that, especially a 6 or 7 year old. And so children are, where you may encounter it happening more often, that you're kind of partway through your session and a child just says, I don't want to do this anymore. And that is something you've got to honor. Now you can say, ethically, you can say to them, well, if you decide tomorrow, I'll be back in your classroom. If you decide tomorrow you want to do it, come to me and we can finish, but you don't have to. So you can give them the option, but you can't be coercive about it. You understand that kind of that line between. But they're probably the group where it happens more often, just because they don't understand what they're about to do. And they might get tired. Other things that you talked about, you've got to be thinking about within your research. There can be things that I said earlier.
We were saying not to have your conclusion written before you started the research, as it might be you might be tempted to.
Yeah, that's good. You'll have your research questions, you have a sense of how you're going to deal with the data, but yeah, being aware that your findings might not be what you expected, which is okay. Right, good. You'll get to keep thinking about these, but I'm going to introduce the second element of the form, which is the risk assessment part. So we've been talking about the ethics, which is kind of how you're looking out for your participants. Risk assessment is a bit more detail of how you're looking after your participants, but it's also how you're looking after yourself. So as part of your ethics application, you'll be doing a risk assessment. And basically what a risk assessment is it's evaluating and preventing potential harm to yourself or to your research participants. And it involves thinking about what the possible risks are, reducing those risks, and planning for unintended risks. Now, that seems like an oxymoron, because how can you plan for something that you don't know about? But having some sort of plan in place when something unexpected happens. And this is especially important for international research. And I don't say this lightly, because in the last year, a PhD student from Cambridge was murdered while doing international research. Now that student was doing something in a fairly controversial area, and you know, the public may never really know what happened. But this is something that we take seriously at Cambridge in terms of thinking about, well, what are the risks, and making sure that you and your supervisor have a plan. So one of the things that I do, for example, is when any of my students collect data internationally, I ask for emergency contact details for their family, and I ask them to make sure that their family have emergency contact details for me. Because if something were to happen, we need to be able to get in contact with each other, right? And so that's just a simple sort of thing to make sure is in place. And these are things you can talk about with your supervisor. Some of you will be doing work that has really no risk other than everyday life. You'll be doing library-based research, or you'll be going into a school, and what you're doing is, it just really doesn't have much of a risk. So for many of you, what you're going to do won't really be that risky. But it is important for us to have a sense that you have thought about the risks and you know what to do if there are any risks that exist, even if they're very unlikely, that you've got kind of a basic plan in place. So a couple of things to think about in terms of reducing risks are making sure that you have all of your medical, personal, accidental, and travel insurance sorted if you're traveling to conduct research. You take any necessary vaccinations or any other medical advice. You're aware of any physically demanding geographical areas, and you're sure you can handle them. Your supervisor knows your travel details. Your supervisor knows when you're traveling. And it's important to think of any local or regional risks. And if they're too great, you might have to change what you're doing. So I think being aware of any political hostilities, especially towards foreign visitors, monitoring any changing developments that might be happening in an international area before you go, and registering with your local embassy in that country. These are just a handful of things that are vitally important, especially if you're doing international work. So this is just a reminder, oh, I missed one date. I have so many dates on my slides. So it's the 24th. It's the same date, but it just happens to fall. Same day, but it's the 24th. I'll fix that as well. So a reminder that everybody has to fill out the ethics and risk assessment. How much detail you have to provide depends on what you're doing. So for people who are doing library-based work, it's pretty simple and straightforward. If you're going to be doing data collection in international settings with risky topics, then it's much less straightforward. Last bit is just a little bit about the various resources that are useful for you to consult, but you've seen the whole list of them on Moodle. What I'd like you to do for the last few minutes of our time together is actually go back to Moodle and go back to the ethics and risk assessment forms, and in your groups, talk about what is the kind of information you might need to be providing for various kinds of questions, so that you've had a chance to think about what's involved in the ethics and risk assessment form, and potentially ask questions of me as you go through it. There are lots of yes-no questions where you've got to basically confirm that you've done one thing or another, or confirm that one thing or another is going to happen in your research. The faculty is taking you at your word when you say yes or no, so it is important that you are honest. You will, in your declaration as part of submitting, you will say that you've answered the questions as honestly as possible. So don't say you've read the BIRA guidelines unless you've read the BIRA guidelines. And the other thing that's important is that if things change substantially, you can come back to us and say there's been a change in my research and I'd just like to modify my ethics or risk assessment. That's perfectly fine. It's better to tell us that there's been a change for us to know about that than for you to start doing something that might be risky or unethical in the process of your changes. So have a look. Whoever has Moodle open, you'll just have to look at it as if they are submitting. And have a look at the questions, talk about if any of them if they're straightforward, you can move on. But some of them, especially as you get into the risk assessment, are a little bit more tricky. So chat in your group about, well, what kinds of things would you put in those sections? Okay, let me draw everyone together and ask if there are any questions about the ethics and risk assessment form that came up in your discussions. Yes?
For the first 20 questions, where it is just yes and no answers, is that pretty much there is a right answer and a wrong answer?
Yes and no. So the idea is basically if you answer no, it means there's potentially something that is ethically sensitive and you'll need to think about how you're going to deal with that, and that's what the paragraph is at the end of that where you're talking about it. So for example, one of the questions is will you be deceptive, or are you going to avoid deception is how I think it's framed. And there's some research where it's important not to tell people what you're doing because it can bias their responses. And so you might have to tell them after. And there are ethically agreed protocols for how you do that in an ethical way. And so it would be something you can talk about with your supervisor in terms of, well, how should I do that? I want to ask this research question, but it involves deception. How do I approach that in an ethical way? So basically what the yes and no questions are flagging is there's something in your research that is potentially sensitive and we just need more information about it. And it's better to be honest about that up front, because then it means you're talking to your supervisor about it, we're seeing it in the application, and we know that you've been talking about it and thinking about how do I deal with this issue that's a difficult one. There's another question or hand. No? Okay, other questions? Are they roughly straightforward enough? I think the risk assessment, you're using the same risk assessment questions that the master's students use. So some of them aren't going to be as appropriate for you, but I think it's better to have a general question with a couple of subheadings for things that you can add in. If you're doing library-based research or if you're doing stuff in schools, in the UK, the risks are pretty minimal, so you don't have to overthink stuff. It's basically just identifying what are the risks of what you're doing.
If you're doing some culturally sensitive research, so rather than multiculturalism, how do you manage to get risks?
There are two kind of things with sensitive research. So one is, there is a question that says, are you doing something that is sensitive, might be deemed sensitive, in part B, where you're given some space to talk about how you're going to deal with that. So that would be something you talk about with your supervisor. How do I ask questions that are going to be appropriate in a sensitive context? So I mentioned the students who are doing stuff linked to sex education. They had to really think about this because this is a sensitive topic. There was a student this last year who wanted to do work linked to refugee children's education and actually ended up doing something that was more of a document analysis of what's available in the UK, because they were worried about how do I ask questions and how do I find students and ask questions, because it's such a sensitive area. So it's thinking about, how am I going to deal with that sensitivity? In terms of the risk assessment, this is where you'll talk to your supervisor about where do you need to worry about cultural sensitivities or just general context. So an example I would give is that if you're doing research in an area that might be sensitive and it might cause someone to have a negative reaction to it. So for example, if you were doing something linked to, I had a friend in graduate school who did some work linked to traumatic childhood events, and she wanted to better understand how people got through those events, and some of it may have been a parent dying or that sort of thing, but that meant that she had to have on hand a person in the counseling center that they could contact if the research bothered them so much that they were finding it difficult to move forward. Now, people knew that what this was about when they signed up for the research, but there still could have been the memories that were brought up as they were going through it might have been really difficult, and someone may have actually needed to speak with a professional afterwards. So it's thinking about, if you're doing something that is sensitive, would it potentially be something that people might find difficult later and they should talk to a professional, so you give them contact numbers for whom they can contact if they are upset after the research, sort of thing. So it's thinking about what kinds of things can you do to alleviate risks, and then if there's something does happen, what can you offer to people? And this is where, again, your supervisor is going to be best placed to help you decide which of those things are going to be appropriate for your research. Other questions? So one of the things that is at the top of the form that you are kind of you are agreeing to, that it's really important. So you agree when you submit this form that you haven't started data collection, because you have to get approval from the R&I Ethics Committee before you can start. You also agree that you have worked on the form with your supervisor. That doesn't mean that you have to look at it together online, but that you're in communication with them about the things, how you might answer some of the questions, if there are any problems. And this is because your supervisor is going to be best placed to help you identify if there are any areas that are potentially ethically sensitive. They'll also be able to help you deal with things like, how do you get consent if they're children versus adults, and based on the risk of your study, do you need written consent from the parents, or can it be a situation where the parents are told about the research and welcome to withdraw their child if they want to? So there are different kinds of things that are important for you to talk with your supervisor about and agree on in relation to ethics. So we are asking you to confirm that you've actually done this form with your supervisor at some level. You don't, just so that they're talking with you about it.
In terms of stuff where you're collecting data from children or parents and stuff, does that only happen if you're doing the design your own project option, or is that?
No, it can happen in any, especially if you get if you become part of an ongoing project, where they're collecting data, you would be going in and collecting data with them. Now, one of the things that can be a benefit of an ongoing project is that they have worked out how to deal with consent already. So you'll follow the protocols of the bigger project, and you don't have to worry about figuring out how to do that, because they will have sorted that as part of the bigger project. You will be part of that potentially, but you don't have to figure out what it is to do.